Le Festival international Nuit d'Afrique, présenté par la TD, vous invite cet été à sa 35e édition anniversaire. Soyez au rendez-vous du 6 au 18 juillet pour célébrer pendant 13 jours l'événement des musiques du monde. Cette édition innovante en salle, en plein air et en webdiffusion vous propose une fusion entre passé et présent, riche en histoire et découvertes musicales. Découvrez toutes les surprises, infos et billetteries sur festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Good morning. You are listening to the F-Files on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. I'm your host this morning, Jules the Ghoul, coming to you with an interview with Ella Den Elzin. Ella Den Elzin is a writer, researcher, and designer based in Montreal, Jaujague. She holds a master's in architecture from McGill University. Currently, she works as a curatorial assistant on exhibitions and research projects on architecture. Through her own practice of design research, she explores the role of architecture and its relationship to questions around borders, migration, and settler colonialism.
So today I would like to talk to you about your project called Between Bodies and Borders, which examines the oppressive nature of immigration holding centers through reconstructing government-issued design guidelines and rebuilding interior spaces based on these documents. So I wonder what drew you to researching immigration detention in general, and more specifically, the Laval Immigration Detention Center?
So, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Tings Chack, who I think really began a lot of this work a number of years ago, and I believe Tings has been involved with Solidarity Across Borders in the past. But they had written an article, or illustrated an article, along with this criminologist in the Funambulist magazine a number of years ago on immigration detention in the UK. And of course, Tings has also written this great illustrated novel or graphic novel called Undocumented. And after sort of reading that, I remember coming across that work in my undergrad and wanting to sort of learn more about these spaces and the way that they're designed. And there was very little literature on them at the time. And I remember doing a lot of trying to even just do a little bit more research into spaces of incarceration or prisons, and finding very few results. I mean, this was in like 2014, 2015, and I think since then a lot of the academic work around this has expanded, but at the time I just remember really feeling like there was a need to kind of write about these spaces and for like the discourse to broaden, just because I feel like architecture schools in general, while this is beginning to change, often are quite rigid in terms of what they teach students or like the kind of topics that we're encouraged to explore. And so I started doing my research then, just in a very preliminary way, and looking at immigration detention centers in general, both here in North America but also in Europe. And at first looking into like questions of so-called ethical design, which, I mean, I would really push back against. I don't think that an ethical prison can really truly exist, but at least starting there, like looking at what architects in these different places were designing. And yeah, this was something that just stayed with me for a while. And when I moved to Montreal, you know, it was around the time where there was a lot of discussion around the Laval Detention Center, but again, I think there was a lot of questions being asked in activist circles, but in general, again, I felt like it was kind of happening outside of the academy and people weren't really talking about it. And since that was the space that I was in, I sort of felt like it was necessary to bring that conversation forward, especially since it was just so timely and happening. You know, the detention center is currently being built in 2021. And I felt like it was something I wanted to engage in, but I was also hoping through the process of working on my project and presenting it to my peers and professors that it would also at least begin to have other architecture students think about these kinds of questions, whether it's immigration detention or, you know, spaces of incarceration or solitary confinement, you know, spaces that are unethical, and to have people actually ask more questions about the kind of briefs that they're being given and not just simply accept them.
For sure. And I understand actually that the details of a building of this nature, like such as the Laval Immigration Detention Center, the details were maybe not easily accessible or readily available, or like maybe there was a lack of transparency there, even though this is at the base public infrastructure. So I wonder, yeah, what your process was to start to even kind of dissect this, or how you found your information and what you kind of relied on when you couldn't find the information that you needed.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, the information around these kinds of buildings is not sort of publicly available. In many ways, it should be, in terms of being able to access it through processes such as access to information requests, which is when you make a request to a government agency for information, which technically they're obligated to give to you as a private citizen. But, you know, there's certain kind of restrictions that the Canadian Border Services Agency or different agencies will sort of use to get around that and sort of say it's, you know, a question of privacy or sort of sensitive information, so they won't release those details in full. And I'm not the first person to do this. I think, you know, many people who've looked at these kinds of spaces, like this other artist based here in Montreal, Sheena Hosko, who's also been looking at spaces of incarceration and the Immigration Detention Center here in Laval, has also been doing, you know, work related to access and information requests. But yeah, usually what you end up with is like quite redacted. And I remember doing a request specifically for plans and for guidelines and never receiving the plans. And so there was online available sort of like the original, what they would call tender documents, which are documents used to hire the architect, the design architect, which in this case ended up being the May Architect based here in Montreal. But the kind of details or plans that I was looking for were never really given to me. And so, yeah, it becomes really hard to understand how these spaces look like or how they operate when that information isn't public knowledge. And I feel like in many ways it's sort of counter to the sort of like public discourse or government discourse that's being shared around them. So for example, in many ways this center was sort of like presented to be as more ethical or better than the current Laval detention facility, which is technically a retrofitted building next to the prison in Laval, and, you know, sort of institutionally appears as such. And I think in many ways, like, the government is trying to, sorry, I know I'm getting away from your original question, but in many ways trying to sort of like rebrand this building as a better alternative. I mean, again, I think that that this really shouldn't be existing as an alternative in the first place, but you can't even begin to sort of like measure that, because it's not, the information, again, is not really being shared, and there's very little transparency around what it will actually look like.
As part of this project, I understand that you actually remodeled or reconstructed several different spaces that would exist in this new detention holding center. So can you describe a bit your process of building these spaces based on the information that you were able to obtain?
Yes. Okay, so, I mean, like I mentioned before, I was able to get the tender documents, which have been circulated before. I think those are available on the Stop the Prison website, which is a website sort of with a number of resources about this project and this building, and sort of the activist movements to stop its construction. But also those are available on government tender websites. And then through the access to information request that I did, like I mentioned, I was able to get kind of updated guidelines, but not the plans in kind of their most updated form. So I call it a speculative reconstruction just because in many ways I'm like starting to combine these documents. And I understand in some ways the ones that I was working from were not as up-to-date as I would like. But in some ways I think the project is trying to highlight those discrepancies, or the fact that, you know, not all this information is readily available to us. And also, I think in many ways these documents aren't always legible to the general public. Like, not everyone can read maybe an architectural plan. And also just in terms of the guidelines, you know, they're very long kind of bureaucratic documents. So I was just trying to figure out a way of making them more accessible and a way of kind of, yeah, making them more readable to kind of the average person in a way that in their current form, yeah, they're really hard to kind of dissect and read. So essentially, I started with the plans and I built these sort of large scale physical models out of wood and paint and paper, and I kind of cross-referenced those with the architectural guidelines, and because I'll sort of stipulate things like what kind of floor finishing or ceiling tile or like these kinds of things, like the quality of the space and like the kind of materials that they're supposed to use and the purpose of the space. So I basically started to build these models based on those two different documents at a relatively large 1 to 10 scale, and then later I filmed them. And the reason I decided to film them instead of just taking photographs or presenting the models was because I was trying to kind of show a durational element to them, and I wanted the film to kind of feel a bit long and drawn out, and like you also are in some ways. I mean, I really don't want to relate the two things together because I think I can't speak to the experience of being in detention, but I think I was just trying to generate a sense of discomfort in the viewer. So that was mostly done through like the filming aspect of the model.
Right, so these are buildings that most of us can't access.
Exactly. And I guess, yeah, and I think something that's important to highlight also is not that they're just inaccessible, but that very few pictures of them exist. So, yeah, journalists and researchers are not really allowed into these spaces, and unlike, you know, I think in the United States where there's been a lot of images circulating of the detention centers at the U.S.-Mexico border, you know, or journalists going inside and sort of talking about the conditions of these spaces since the COVID-19 pandemic, and, you know, like the kind of implication that that's really had on people who are being held inside these spaces, or like, you know, the conversation around kids in cages in the United States and like actual images being distributed of those spaces. I feel like there's been a lot less discussion around what we in Canada are doing. Like, for example, when I was working on this project, I think, you know, a lot of people I was speaking with didn't even realize that we detain children here or families, and they really thought that that was something that only takes place in the United States. And I guess I'm through this project, I'm really trying to get people to challenge some of their assumptions and to think a little bit more about what it means to have these spaces that exist in our society that are in many ways invisible to a lot of us.
Right. Like, I think people obviously know that prisons exist, and a lot of people think that prisons need to exist for one reason or another. But I think, like, this is an area that I think maybe is less present in the minds of average citizens. Don't know that the immigration holding center exists, or like that this is a detention center, or that people stay there without having, with the court facing any charges. Actually, in some ways, it's worse than prison because you don't have any charges, and then you don't, so you have no way to know how or when you can leave.
Exactly, and that's the other thing actually about Canada that's quite unique, is that we actually don't have a limit on the amount of days that someone can be held in detention, which actually the UN has pushed back against quite a bit. But like, our track record on this has been quite bad, but I don't feel like there's actually been enough conversation around it. I think there's a little bit more discussion happening here in Quebec since the construction that's been happening here. Like, we have two other large immigration holding centers, one in Toronto and one near Vancouver Airport. But in general, I feel like, and a lot of the construction that's happened on these facilities has really taken place in the last 10 years. So I believe the one in Toronto was finished in something like 2014. And actually, it's like recently been expanded. So since 2014, they've actually built a whole other wing. So I think that's the other thing to keep in perspective, or is that the government in many ways is not trying to consider alternate strategies for people who are coming to Canada and thinking of ways of possibly housing them, or actually sort of taking care of them. Instead, the kind of like first alternative or in their mind is really to imprison them. And like you mentioned, there's not really any kind of, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it just from the people that I've spoken to who work in the legal profession, it sounds like it is a very convoluted process. In terms of, you know, trying to get someone's status, or even, yeah, the ability to sort of seek asylum. And the other thing, I guess, to keep in mind with a lot of these spaces is that the reason I think they're important really to consider is just because they in many ways reinforce the idea, I think, to the average Canadian citizen who's not thinking about things critically, that people deserve criminalization, or that coming here without papers means that you will be criminalized, and that that is a criminal offense. And by essentially building a prison for people who don't necessarily have status, you're reinforcing that idea, yeah, as opposed to really thinking about other solutions. Because, you know, already, like, we have a shortage of housing. Like, I think there's a lot of other ways that we could be using our resources or thinking about how to take care of these people.
So I wanted to hear a little bit more about the video you mentioned. It's called A Warm and Homey Feeling, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, basically, the video work that you've made kind of puts the viewer inside of these models that you have constructed. And, yeah, you mentioned this sense of duration and the sense of discomfort. I wondered how you were able to kind of to do it, and why it was important to have this kind of full sensorial experience, rather than just creating diagrams or just creating a model.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think diagrams and models are like the format that I'm most comfortable with, because I think that's often how they teach you to represent your ideas. at least in architecture school. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, making a film was important because, again, I was trying to, you know, give people a more, like, embodied feeling or a feeling of sort of being immersed in this space. And I also like playing with the idea of scale. So, you know, having a small model that can sit on a tabletop. And I think sort of, like, in some ways speaks to, like, the architect as a professional or as someone who's, you know, designing these spaces and has a certain level of control, you know, even though they're maybe responding to certain government guidelines or documents, you know. I think, yeah, having a sort of small scale model really speaks to the way in which, in some cases, yeah, these spaces are, like, designed and constructed in someone's mind, but are not necessarily, like, their lived reality. But then by turning it into a film and projecting it on a much larger scale, then that relationship kind of becomes subverted, and then you're now inside the space. So that's kind of what I was trying to do with the film. And then a warm and homey feeling, like that phrase actually comes from one of the government tender documents.
No way.
Yes, so they were saying, like, we would like to create, in one of the original documents, not created by LeMay, but created by this other architecture firm based in Vancouver who designed the Vancouver Immigration Detention Center. When they were sort of creating the first schematic design for the project, they had said, like, we want to use wood structure for the building to create a warm and homey feeling. And so I was actually, again, trying to sort of, like, highlight the irony of that text. Right now, it's sort of like the first moment where a lot of these buildings are actually being built. I would say in, like, the last sort of, again, like 10 to 5 years, even in some cases less than 10 years, like the last decade. Before this, we were sort of, you know, repurposing other buildings, whether it was prisons or in some cases hotels. These were really kind of like ad hoc spaces. But we're now in a moment where, yeah, the government sees them as a necessity, and so it's actually building purpose-built spaces. So I think, like, now is really the moment to be questioning that or, like, pushing back against that, considering that, like, this new typology of building is going to become normalized in a way. Like, the more we build, like, the more we kind of continue to expand, and that's just going to become, like, another kind of building as we, like, is this another kind of building we as a society want to accept? That will kind of just, like, become part of the fabric of society.
I also wanted to ask you about the speculative function of architectural design, which you kind of touched on now, like, what kind of buildings need to exist in a society, and what kind of, like, how we build, how is society reflected in the what we choose to build, and how is what we choose to build shaping the way that we live. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the role that architects could have in building more equitable or compassionate futures through design?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and that's something I'm still sort of trying to think about. And I think that's something that I even maybe had a hard time answering while working on sort of, like, the early phases of this research. So I think there's two answers, I guess, I have to your question. So the first part, in terms of what kind of architectures do we want to accept as a society, or what should exist? So, I mean, I think it's, like, a reciprocal relationship in many ways. Like, I think the problem with architects, and I mean, that's something that's easier, a bit easier for me to speak to in a way, because that's something I have more familiarity with, but is that I think we as a profession really want to absolve ourselves of the responsibility of, like, thinking about these kinds of political questions and place that on to other people, or like, you know, say, oh, that's about policy, that's not something that we play a role in executing, even though it's like, you know, these buildings can't really come to be without our expertise. And I wonder, like, what would it look like if the architectural profession were to actually, like, boycott designing these kinds of spaces? You know, like, I think people always say, well, there would be, like, an engineering firm or somebody else who would take on that project, like, if in sort of, like, neoliberal capitalist society that we exist in, you know, there was someone who would always take the work, which I think we need to, like, push back on more, or sort of, if as a profession people were to sort of think more critically, like, I think, you know, a lot of places architects do take kind of both, especially in Quebec, actually, because there's, like, you know, there's an order of architects, where, you know, you're sort of, like, in some ways similar to, like, the way a doctor would, swearing to protect society or, like, taking on a certain amount of responsibility. So I think people need to sort of consider this as being part of that. And again, like I was saying before, I think by building these buildings or designing these buildings and having these kinds of structures become institutionalized through architecture and through building, it kind of reinforces to society that, like, yes, we need a detention center. Yes, these people deserve to be criminalized, which, I mean, I take a strong position against. And so, which I think more architects should. And then to go back to your second question about taking, like, a more compassionate approach, I think it's, like, sort of twofold. Like, historically, architecture has been a very historically white male profession, and I think that's beginning to change. But I think part of having a more compassionate approach is really also just, like, having a more sort of diverse group of voices within the profession and having, you know, more people who are practicing architects who maybe represent the communities that they're actually trying to work for. You know, it's also historically a very sort of middle-class profession. At one point was even kind of considered, like, a profession of nobility, like, not so much in the 20th century, but, yeah, like, kind of has these roots. And so I think until we sort of start to, like, begin to dismantle that and also just have more people working within the profession, people coming from more diverse backgrounds, people coming from, yeah, different perspectives who can contribute to that conversation and begin to, like, actually shape those discussions and, like, work with the communities that they're from and who can actually, like, acknowledge or have a better understanding of, like, how to present solutions through design. Like, I mean, I don't always think design is a solution. I think actually, like, involves a much more involve community consultation process, which I don't always think designers are very good at doing. Like, I think designers like to think of themselves as visionaries and, like, to impose sort of things onto other people, and it's, like, a bit of a god complex in a way. I don't want to, like, generalize too much, but I think there's been a lot of that historically within design and design culture, and I think that's beginning to shift. But in order to move away from that, I think there has to be some understanding of the community that whom you're trying to design for, and, yeah, just more conversation, more discussion. And also, I think that's sort of beginning to happen more, but needs to maybe be more considered as a way of sort of figuring out how architects can, you know, sort of take on multiple roles, like, not necessarily just as a designer, but have, like, a better understanding in some ways of the policy questions or other discussions that are happening alongside, which, again, I think some people are interested in and is beginning to change, but, like, having a more kind of, like, involved hand in the process, as opposed to just constantly sort of being like, no, we take these directions from other people, we have a brief from a client, and we're just responding to it, and, like, figuring out ways for designers to, like, begin to shape the brief.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Le Festival International de Nuit d'Afrique, presented by TD Bank, invites you to their 35th anniversary this summer. Discover the outdoor festival from July 13th to the 18th. For 6 days, share special moments with the artists, intimate concerts, workshops and demonstrations free or by appointment, and witness the breathtaking projections happening every evening. In partnership with Quartier du Spectacle, Metro Celarin. Check out the full program at festivalnuitdafrique.com.